Hey guys, welcome back to the Street Cop Podcast. I'm your host, founder and CEO of Street Cop Training. My name is Dennis Bonino, and today with me, Vic Galarza, Street Cop instructor, Mexican cartel expert, former national. Are you dual citizenship for Mexico?
I actually surrendered my Mexican citizenship.
Okay, no longer Mexican. Straight up, Estados Unidos, amigos.
Estados Unidos, naturalized United States citizen. The honor of being an American citizen.
It's great, dude. What a wonderful thing. And we left off last time. Vic was walking us through the culture of the Mexican cartels. We kind of scratched the surface of the, you know, the mindset and some of the organizational structure of these organizations. Today, Vic is going to continue to explain more things associated with Mexican drug cartels. So without further ado, Vic, give them the 30-second bio of you and then go into part two.
So again, a former Mexican diplomat arrived in the United States, eventually became an immigrant myself, surrendered my diplomatic status, a G1, later an A1 diplomatic status, actually vice versa, A1 and G1, became a naturalized United States citizen and had the opportunity to become a law enforcement officer here in the great state of Colorado, where I'm active as a narcotics agent, narcotics detective with a small drug task force, and founded the Vigilance Project back about, I want to say, 2018. And later on in 2000, just actually this year or last year, I had the opportunity to join you folks with Street Cop, and it's been a great pleasure to do so. So that's kind of like me on a very nice little neat ball, if you could say that.
Where are we going today on the journey into Mexico and the narco culture?
I think a great opening for this podcast would be continuing with the webinar that we concluded, was it last week or 2 weeks ago, about the occult of the Santa Muerte. Had a lot of questions, had a lot of comments, and had a lot of interest in regards to that specific subject when you're talking about the mass subject that is narcocultura. In narcocultura, we're not just talking about the culture of narcos or the transnational criminal organizations, which we're talking today in Mexico. When you're talking about narcos, you're talking about the criminal element in Mexico, period. And that is between 300 and 800 transnational criminal organizations, drug trafficking organizations or DTOs, regional mafias, other gangs, and other organized entities in Mexico today. That's when we're talking about narcocultura. And a big interest that I've actually seen with law enforcement officers and other members of the media, government, so on and so forth, is the occult of Santa Muerte and the misconceptions that actually are around that specific subject, which are just drastic throughout the board.
I just want to point out one thing that, Vic, I'm guessing your timelines in your life are completely off because it was way longer than 2 weeks ago, my friend, that we did this. So I don't know how you need to get yourself like a Google Calendar because, dude, that was like 2 months ago.
Everything just spiders together, let me tell you.
Let me tell you. I see that.
Yes, absolutely it does.
Let's move forward with what are some of the questions you've received and what are some of the answers you have given or want to give on this podcast?
So the very first thing I want to start with is the understanding that this is an actual religion. In fact, it's a religion that is followed between 10 and 15 million people around the world. It's a syncretism. A syncretism is when you grab one religion and you combine it with the other and you get a completely different thing. It is believed that this specific religion, the occult of the Santa Muerte, began in ancient pre-Columbian Mexico with the worship of death at that point in time, which was actually done by the Mexicas or the Aztec people back in Mexico. Eventually, throughout history, that religion or that following to the deity of death was combined with other different beliefs in Mexico. And we begin with the belief of Espiritualismo Mariano Trinitario, an actual religious spiritualism following that occurred during Mexico, during the biggest political event in Mexico, which was the Mexican Revolution. To understand that concept in the Mexican mind at that point in time in 1910, you had about 1.5 million people died during this one conflict in Mexico. So death is very imminent. Death is very visual, very prevalent, very right on people's faces. And there's this movement, this spiritualist movement that is known as Espiritualismo Mariano Trinitario. It uses three concepts: spirituality. Mariano speaks about the Virgin Mary, La Virgen de Guadalupe in Mexico at that point in time. And then you have Trinitario, which speaks about the Trinity, the Holy Trinity. One thing people need to remember is that Mexico is the second largest Roman Catholic country in the entire globe. So it would be obvious and normal for a Mexican national to have a saint, to have any type of religious icon whatsoever. At this point in time in Mexico City, that syncretism that began with the deity of death in pre-Columbian times, then you throw in Espiritualismo Mariano Trinitario, and then you throw in the rest of the beliefs, it splintered out and it became the occult of the Santa Muerte, which is now practiced between 10 and 15 million people around the world. And it's a religious belief that is not that does not follow or continue with the beliefs of the Holy Roman Catholic Church. By itself is an actual religion, and by itself is protected by our First Amendment. This religion, the occultist or the followers, is not a worship, it's a following. The followers of the Santa Muerte believe that she is a gift-granting godmother whose job is to take you one day to the arms of God. Now, as a Roman Catholic myself, this is my favorite definition of her or name for her, godmother. Because it's for a Roman Catholic, it helps you understand what these devotees believe she is, because they believe she's death herself. Now they call death the godmother because one day she will bring you to the arms of God. Let me give you an example of this. Your godmother as a Roman Catholic or your godfather brought you to the arms of God when they baptized you. That is the same thing that death is going to do one day. It's going to bring you to the arms of God. So that's what a devotee actually believes the Santa Muerte is. She's a gift-granting godmother who you can ask anything for. You can ask for money. You can ask for love. You can ask for health. You can ask with assistance for legal problems. You can ask for, a multitude of different things. And that is represented by the colors in the actual effigy. The effigy or the statue. So that specific effigy that you're calling death to actually reside on has a specific power that death will provide you assistance of.
I'm very familiar with all this because I've seen the movie Book of Life and Coco. Have you seen those?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And it's actually, I was just actually mentioning this to another individual that's actually interested in actually hosting one of our classes in Florida. And it's the connection between Mexican culture and now American culture, because American culture has definitely influenced Mexican culture, and Mexican culture, perfect example, what you just said, has influenced American culture itself.
It's a wonderful culture at that.
It's a culture that has received various influences throughout the eons. I mean, you're talking about the Spanish arriving in Mexico in 1521 and actually changing Mexico in the face of Mexico on what, you know, we are seeing now, which mm-hmm. is a beautiful combination of different cultures, just like we are here in the United States. And again, that's another beauty about this specific class, is that it's not only about drug trafficking. It's not only about the Mexican cartels. It's also about teaching our law enforcement officers culture that applies to the jurisdictions that they're providing service to. So it by itself, it's a cultural awareness class as well.
I would like to, on behalf of every American, thank you and the country of Mexico for Selma Hayek. So we appreciate that.
Which, by the way, did you know she's half Lebanese? I myself, have a little Lebanese in me.
Really?
Yes. Italian, Lebanese, Spanish.
I can see that. You know, did you do the 23andMe or like the ancestry.com?
My brother did it, my younger brother. And we actually found that we also have a little 2% Jewish.
Oh, so, well, mazel tov, my friend.
I'm very interested in the
mazel.
That side of my heritage.
You're going to need to contact your parents and ask for a bar mitzvah.
I know, right?
So back to the narco culture.
And so for us to understand the difference between criminal behavior and non-criminal behavior as it relates to the Oculto de Santa Muerte, there is a specific criminal subculture, narcocultura, that has adopted this actual entity, this death itself, to actually represent a specific thing. This is when they're grabbing this belief and make it into a symbol. Not so much a belief for them, but a symbol. There's a purpose behind them utilizing the Santa Muerte. It's almost the same example that I give for the swastika. You know, the swastika dates back in history, eons, to the indigenous people of Alaska, the indigenous people of the Americas, the indigenous people of Asia Minor, in religions like Buddhism, Shintoism. The Vikings actually used it. Thor, the god Thor, actually used the symbol of the swastika, but we didn't see it in the, you know, in the modern movies, because now this symbol to us means a completely different thing, because a certain group adopted the symbol to make it a specific meaning. In this case, the Nazi Party, back just before World War II. And eventually, after World War II, another hate group adopted that symbol to mean a specific thing. So in the case of the Santa Muerte, why would an individual that support narcocultura, why would they actually utilize this entity as a symbol? One, they believe, the occult, that she's death herself. Imagine yourself as a criminal element in Mexico, which is now running with impunity throughout probably 30 to 35% of that country. Imagine them utilizing a symbol that means death. The impression that would actually have on the Mexican non-criminal element, it's a powerful symbol, because now they're controlling death. They have control. They have death in their pocket. And they're portraying her, because it's a her, they're portraying her to be in their side. The terror that creates, the fear that creates within the communities of Mexico is drastic. I mean, it's enormous. And then think about this as well. The vast majority of Mexican nationals are going to be Roman Catholic, right? Because Mexico is the second largest Roman Catholic country in the entire world. Can you imagine a certain criminal element controlling a symbol that for a Roman Catholic is the number one sin? Can you imagine them utilizing that symbol to represent narcocultura to a point? And also, within the group itself, it actually creates control in loyalties within a group. Give you an example, kind of like an occult from in Texas. The what is the name of that occult that happened in Waco, Texas? The Davidians that actually believed that this individual, this man, represented the new Messiah, and they died for that Messiah at the end of this enormous taking of life that happened in Waco. Horrible, horrible event, but it's what they believed. And so can you imagine the type of unity and control within an organization that a specific symbol will have? That's another reason why they utilize the Santa Muerte to that point. And there's some very drastic behaviors that some of these individuals will actually go to use this symbol. There's a perfect example that I give during my classes of the removal of the hand. So you have an actual effigy, an actual statue. And the vast majority of these statues can be made in Mexico, but now actually China has been involved in the manufacture of these effigies because a lot of people are buying it. And it's just another way for China and China companies to actually make money, obviously, right? So these effigies, you can actually remove the hand because it's connected through just a simple screw. But the act, it's the act that that represents. What they do is they take the hand of death, because they believe she's death herself. They remove the hand of death and they keep that hand under their control. And they tell death, I will not give you your hand back until you provide for me whatever I'm asking you for. I mean, just the drastic behavior of doing that, that will give you an idea of the use of this individual deity, of this individual religious belief in a criminal behavior. It's a very complicated thing and takes me literally 2.5 hours just to explain the Oculto de Santa Muerte and some of the criminal behaviors surrounding this belief.
Interesting. Okay, so progressing forward, what does that lead us into?
That leads us into what we called factors in your investigations. So let's say, for example, a normal police officer that's got very little experience in law enforcement, and it's all about training, obviously. It's all about learning. You encounter something like a Mexican national or a non-Mexican national holding a necklace, a tattoo, a scapular, a statue in a vehicle. By itself, it's not an indicator. Let me express this very clearly. It's not an indicator of criminal behavior by itself, because we deal with probability, right? 10 to 15 million people. It's more probable that they're actually praying or utilizing La Santa Muerte as a non-criminal behavior than a criminal behavior, is when you start noticing the criminal behaviors involved. And these criminal behaviors involve certain breaks of the rules between the Oculto de Santa Muerte and what the narcocultura practices. Give you an example. So let's say, for example, I have a Santa Muerte statue and a St. Jude statue. And I'm just giving you examples, right? These two statues, for example. The Oculto de Santa Muerte, they know her as a jealous bitch. So the rules of the occult actually express no other Roman Catholic patron saint or no folk saint to be combined with her belief. And the Holy Roman Catholic Church, St. Jude, believes that she is the very first sin. I shall not have someone before thee. So right there and then, you're getting rid of two religious beliefs, the Holy Roman Catholic Church and the Oculto de Santa Muerte. Now then, there's a specific reason why they're using this specific statue for the occult, for the Santa Muerte, and there's a specific reason why they will use St. Jude. That's when you start developing your factors that will play into your investigations. And obviously from there, you move on to the story, right? One of the biggest thing, there's various of our colleagues that say the story, the interview is one of the most important things that you can do during these investigations. When you bring in somebody into your vehicle, right? And then you're like, so what is that? You're not asking them about religion at that point in time. You're asking them about, is this a symbol or not? So what is that? What specifically is that? And they start lying to you because they think they know what you're seeing, what you know you're seeing as a Santa Muerte, as a symbol of narcocultura. If they're lying to you, then yes, that will become an actual indicator on the furtherance of your investigation. Another example, when you start looking at logos, at symbols, a very prevalent symbol would be el gallo or the rooster, right? The rooster in narcocultura represents actually two things, while it represents other things in normal non-criminal behaviors. For example, the rooster for a Mexican national means a singer, because a rooster in the morning, what do? They go out and sing. So there's various singers, famous singers around Mexico that they call him El Gallo de Sinaloa or El Gallo de Mexico, the great singer of Sinaloa or the great singer of Mexico. By itself, is non-criminal behavior. But when you start combining these factors in your investigation and you all of a sudden see a gallo, which in narcocultura represents two things, methamphetamine, and in previous years, marijuana as well. So today it means those two things, marijuana and methamphetamina, crystal, glass. So that's when you start figuring out additional things that will help you in the furtherance of your investigation. The utilizing of symbols, which Santa Muerte can actually be.
Now, does the rooster also mean they've earned a certain amount of money?
Rooster earns a certain amount of money. Gallo by itself, so it could be the singer, or it can actually be a fighter as well. Because when you're, what do gallos do during a cockfight? They fight each other. Does it mean necessarily that they're, I think you're looking at the head of the organization, El Gallo, the boss, the chief. In certain cases, it may actually be that. But it doesn't mean necessarily that they're making a certain amount of money. It's more of a leadership status because of the level of acceptance El Gallo means within Mexican culture, because he's the fighter. He's the great fighter.
I know that Brad Gilmore, who's one of our instructors, will tell a story of a incident where he had a gentleman under arrest. And then he said to the guy, I see you have the rooster on your hat. And mm-hmm. I forgot what the value of money is on it. This guy was moving. He was a trafficker. Mm-hmm. And Brad said, you've made more than $200,000 or $250,000 for the organization. That's your trophy, right? And the guy said, how did you know that? Mm-hmm. Have you heard of something like that before?
I have not. I've never heard of that.
Yeah. You can ask Brad. You ask Brad about that one. And he said that the guy acknowledged that he knew that was a thing. He was actually surprised that he knew that.
Yeah, it would be the type of what I've experienced is the title of being on top of a certain level of the organization, not necessarily the amount of money that somebody may have had. Now, remember, we're talking about between 300 and 800 different criminal entities within Mexico. Does everybody operate the same way? Is there no, there's changes. There are variations between a group that might be operating in Mexico City or the seven groups that are operating in Mexico City compared to the two groups that operate in Baja California.
What are the top groups right now that are involved in the drug trafficking trade? The biggest cartels in the country of Mexico.
So again, I wouldn't call them, we call them cartels just so everybody can understand. But in reality, we're talking about the transnational criminal organizations, the TCOs. And so right now at the very top is CJNG, Las Cuatro Letras, the four letters, Cartel Jalisco Nueva Generación. And in fact, the leader of Cartel Jalisco Nueva Generación, which is El Mencho, his name is El Señor de los Gallos, the Lord of the Roosters, the Lord of the roosters. So again, that gives you another definition to that. See how it actually means a specific different thing for them. You also have the groups that operate under the flag of the Sinaloa cartel. What do I mean about the groups that operate under the flag of the Sinaloa cartel? In Mexico, in reality, criminality has become very difficult to predict due to the splintering of these groups. And that's exactly what happened to what we know as the Sinaloa cartel or the Pacific cartel or the Pacific organization, also known as the Guzman Loera organization. It has splintered into various different groupings. You have El Mayo Zambada now being part of one specific group within that organization. You have Caro Quintero now being part of that organization. This is the man that killed Kiki Camarena back in the 80s when I was in Mexico. Also, you have Los Chapitos, the three kids or the three sons of El Chapo Guzman, who are actually taking a part of the organization to another level. And then on top of that, you have, again, other various organizations, like, let's say, for example, Los Viagra, the Viagra cartel. You also have La Nueva Familia Michoacana. You have the H3 cartel. You have the reminiscences of the Tijuana cartel. You have the reminiscences of the Juarez cartel. You have also the splintering groups of Los Zetas cartel. You probably have heard of Los Zetas cartel and how some people still call them Los Zetas cartel. In reality, it's again the various groups that hold the flag of Los Zetas, because right now, one of the most dangerous criminal organizations in Mexico is El Cartel del Noroeste, which is a splinter group of the Zetas cartel by itself. So you have various groups, El Gulf cartel, let's not forget about that. And then you have other organizations that are coming and becoming stronger, that at one point in time were smaller criminal organizations, and now they're rising to the level of transnational organizations like Guerreros Unidos. Guerreros Unidos is the group that's basically in control of the Pentágono de Amapola, the Poppy Pentagon, which is in the state of Guerrero, where Acapulco is. This organization came from that place and are very much in control of the production and manufacturing of heroin, which comes from that state, the Poppy Pentagon. So you have, like I said, it's a very complicated issue and very difficult to predict because of the splintering of these organizations. You know, one comes in and three all of a sudden erect. Now we have them operating in. That's why I spend a lot of time teaching about the criminal behaviors, because if we start talking about individual groups, we'll be having a class for a month, and then we would have to start again because of the splintering of these groups.
There's a lot to unpack, huh?
Oh, yeah.
What are three significant things people need to consider when we're talking about maybe an investigation tied back to the cartels? What's some good advice you can give?
I think we'll concentrate on advice on patrol officers and officers out there trying to get an interdiction. And one of the things is not so much a criminal behavior, but it's a Mexican behavior. We don't believe in personal space at all. So you would actually see a Mexican national approaching a law enforcement officer out of respect. So always keep in mind, keep your distance, and you got to express that to them. Also remember that for a Mexican national to see a law enforcement officer doing a traffic contact, remember how law enforcement is in Mexico. In Mexico, law enforcement at a lower level has an incredible bad reputation of corruption and impunity, taking law into their own hands, into their own matters, and not doing something constitutionally. So that is the reputation that law enforcement has as a lower level, the municipal level, the state level, the city level in Mexico. Once you get into the federal level, it's a different thing. So keep that in mind. These are the eyes that are actually seeing you as an American law enforcement officer conducting a traffic stop. The nervousness, the concern. And on top of it, remember that, again, illegal immigration is a very true fact. So while you're conducting these investigations, you might get the sense of nervousness because, again, you might be dealing with a illegal immigrant, which as a county employee myself, I don't uphold immigration law at all. And that's actually one of the very things I do when I used to do criminal interdiction. I would go to a possible Mexican contact and be like, dude, just so you know, I am not immigration. I am not here to deport you. I don't care if you're here legally or illegally. I am only concerned at that point in time during a traffic stop. So that's another thing that officers need to realize. And then once you get into these investigations, especially in rural areas, like say, for example, here in the Four Corners, where you have shitty cell service, shitty computer service, your radio service is basically crap as well, and your closest backup is literally an hour away. Keep in mind some of the tactics that these organizations actually use, kind of like riding on convoys, you know, the splitting of an actual load, not just into one vehicle, but various vehicles. That's something that you have to keep in mind. Keep mind of your surroundings. keep in mind that while you're conducting a traffic stop on one vehicle, you might have other one or two actually passing you by, or even another one conducting surveillance on your ass while doing this. In fact, they're even known to actually put cameras and recording devices in these vehicles that actually load vehicles to actually get intel on whoever's actually doing the traffic stop during this contact. So keep that in mind.
How far is the outreach in the United States of the Mexican drug trafficking organizations? Because I think a lot of people in the Northeast, maybe on the East Coast, they're under the impression that there is no influence here. Maybe you could shed some light on the truth behind this, the influence here. And the reason they don't think it's here is because I guess in their mind, they're not experiencing it. And I would probably argue that the Mexican drug cartel here is doing a very good job at keeping a very low profile. So maybe you can elaborate on that.
There is a reason why the Department of Justice has called the Mexican cartels the number one criminal threat to the United States. The Mexican cartels are in a position to actually operate here in the United States uncomparably to any other organization in the entire world. So that's number one. And it's not just in the United States, it's in North America. Give you some examples. People in Chicago, people in Illinois might have known that El Chapo Guzman, who's actually now a resident of Colorado, by the way, El Chapo Guzman was the number one wanted criminal in Chicago, even though he himself never actually put a foot in Chicago. There's no evidence of that. This is how big his organization was, not just in Chicago, but in the surrounding areas. That's one example. Another example, Canada, for example. There is evidence that El Chapo Guzman was in bed with the Canadian Iranian mafia to actually provide narcotics to Canada itself. The vast majority of the dope that El Chapo Guzman was bringing in to the United States through the southern border was in privately owned vehicles. So now you know that these privately owned vehicles would go all the way up the United States into Canada, distributing these narcotics. So you're seeing the highways literally throughout the United States being put in with either associates of the Mexican cartels and or Mexican cartels themselves taking these loads. You mentioned Brad. He says in his own class, like, if you believe that there's no cartels in your streets, you're blinded. You are absolutely blind. Who do you think takes fentanyl to New York? So a 1 kilo, 2.2 pounds of pure fentanyl powder in Mexico, it takes you about $2,200 to actually produce. That same key that you take to New York City, that same key, once you break it up, you can make up to $1 million.
Wow.
$1 million in New York City of pure fentanyl, which is right now, hands down, one of the biggest threats we're experiencing in the United States. So can you imagine the amount of monies and the amount of power and the amount of personnel that it would actually take to actually bring these products into the United States? There's one city in Sinaloa, it's called Los Mochis, which is a mountainous area of Sinaloa. It is estimated that just alone in that city, last year, they produced 400 million M30 counterfeit fentanyl pills. Just in that one city. Do you think if that they were just taking to your local area, if you're finding them through mail, does it go through mail? Absolutely it does. But do you think 400 million of them just arrived in your area or throughout the United States via mail or just via car, via just people walking in and on the planes? They're everywhere. So if you believe that the Mexican cartels are not represented in your cities, in your communities, we got some work to do.
Do the Mexican cartels work in conjunction and hand in hand with other cartels like Dominican cartels? How does that work?
One case that I just literally, it's being adjudicated federally, is somebody that's connected to a criminal organization and a motorcycle gang. I'm not going to kind of emphasize on that specific thing, on that specific investigation, but I will give you some examples that the Mexican cartels not only use other organizations like street gangs and motorcycle gangs to actually distribute and sell their narcotics, but other criminal organizations around the world. I just gave you an example of the Iranian mafia in Canada, right? They're in bed with the Colombian militant groups to actually produce cocaine. The cocaine production in Colombia is controlled by the Mexican cartels. The Mexican cartels are in bed with La Cosa Nostra, the Italian, the Mexican cartels are in bed with Russian mafia. You tell me how powerful the Russian mafia is in New York, in New York City. Where do you think they're getting their dope? Where do you think they're getting fentanyl? Where do you think they're getting the counter C30 pills? Where are by far the one organization that is actually expertise in manufacturing those pills is the Chapitos from Sinaloa. So if you're seeing these pills in your neck of the woods, they're coming from one place and one place only. Yeah, they're everywhere.
Yeah, it's interesting. I had a kid one time on the phone said to me, there's no cartels in Mexico, in New Jersey. And I went, oh, okay, I'm sorry. I just realized that I just said something completely idiotic. And I said, that is probably one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Just because you don't see it, don't think that it's not here or in your neck of the woods. I think a lot of law enforcement has to really concede and try to conceptualize how big these organizations are and how impactful they are in their own local jurisdictions. And everybody's just naive because it's not constantly exposed, it's not constantly discovered. And the reason it's not constantly discovered is because there is not training to discover it. So where we focus our energy and efforts is to try to discover these things, disrupt them, because that's what we're supposed to do as law enforcement officers.
Correct. And these groups hide in plain sight. And if we're not able to recognize the behaviors, the non-criminal versus the criminal, that's how they're able to actually fool us in thinking, oh, there's no cartels. Really? Wow. Okay.
Vic, how many police officers in Mexico would you consider to be corrupt versus honest?
Man, that's a hard question. And to be very honest, you know, my family back in Mexico, my grandfather actually was one of the founding fathers for a law enforcement agency that provided service and security for the banking and industrial industries in Mexico. So I know this for a fact. So I want to say that at a lower level, in a lower jurisdiction level, the municipal, the city law enforcement, I want to say an educated guess, because that's all you could do, an educated guess. 50 to 60% at a more federal level, I want to say it's going to be a little less, maybe 30% at a federal level. And you got to figure out that law enforcement at a federal level right now in Mexico, it's a combination of the former federal police force, Policía Federal Judicial, and law enforcement provided to the military. They actually combined the various battalions, military police battalions, with the former Mexican federal police and united them and turned it into La Guardia Nacional, the National Guard.
But interesting.
And within that, they don't even have the ability to actually provide not only law enforcement duties to the people of Mexico, but also the safeguarding of the border, the safeguarding of the 17,000 miles of oil in Mexico. Because right now we're looking at a second war in Mexico, which is the theft of oil by $1 billion a year from the nationalized company Pemex, Petróleos Mexicanos, Mexican Petroleum, which actually, owns Mexican petroleum in Mexico. So they're not able to provide all this different services to the needs of the Mexican people. And now you have the injection back again of normal military units and the Mexican Navy as well.
It's all very interesting stuff. I mean, really, to know, and you know, I think what makes it so interesting is that we're so close to the border and so ingrained in this, I don't know how you want to describe it, or a term that would accurately define what we're involved in. But it's certainly something that when you talk about the culture of law enforcement, Mexican cartels and trafficking is a major thing that we see consistently here in the United States, stemming from where? Mexico. I mean, anything you watch on National Geographic or any of those other Discovery Network, where they are doing behind the scenes and deep diving into these cartels, you know, it really is a significant factor in the society of the United States. It's very interesting.
Mm-hmm. And the use, I mean, unfortunately, we have millions of people that have died due to overdoses. Last year, it was actually just put up by the Center for Disease Control that 107,000 people died of overdoses relating to fentanyl last year. Well, the vast majority of them fentanyl. That is, according to them, one person every 5 minutes. One person every 5 minutes actually dies of an overdose. And hands down, there's empirical evidence, there is lab evidence that states the vast majority of methamphetamine coming into the United States comes in from Mexico. The vast majority of, and I'm talking, you know, up in the 90% of heroin, 80 and 90% of heroin is coming in from Mexico. And now we have the threat of fentanyl and what COVID actually did to the precursors coming in from China over to Mexico. And they say that necessity is the mother of all inventions, right? So now we have actual Mexican criminal element manufacturing the precursors of fentanyl and methamphetamine that they were getting by the tons from China. When that kind of got interrupted with COVID, now we have the Mexican element doing these precursors so they can do their own version of various different types of fentanyl. I've been reading that there is a recipe for fentanyl. Up to a million different recipes to actually make fentanyl and make these pills.
That's wild, man.
When we're talking about the pills, the Oxy 30 pills, the counterfeit fentanyl pills, two out of every five have a lethal dose.
Wow.
Two out of every five. And people literally think that the Mexican cartels are doing this because they want to kill Americans. So they want to do this and they want to do that. They want to make money. The concept of a Mexican transnational criminal organization, the only purpose behind that is to make an actual profit. Mm-hmm. There was a former Mexican president that actually got with an American president, and that American president said, like, hey, why don't you stop the distribution and importation of narcotics into the United States? And the Mexican president said, like, well, while we are the trampling, this is when we're talking about the cocaine coming in from Canada, from Colombia to Mexico and over to the United States, while Mexico is the trampling of narcotics, the United States is the biggest pool because of the demand of narcotics in our nation, unfortunately.
It's wild.
And while some people think that law enforcement is a catch-all that we need to do with the addiction and the issues and everything else, our job as law enforcement officers, I just had a class here locally for our community, and they were asking me, like, well, what kind of services do you provide for our community that's addicted to these narcotics? I'm like, folks, I am an investigator. I am a detective. I am a narcotics agent. My duty is to stop the influx of these products coming into the United States and coming into Colorado and coming into my county. That is my job. That's the job as us as law enforcement officers. Be proactive. Go out there and get it. Go out there and learn how to get it. Because if we don't, that's when we start seeing the deaths.
Very interesting stuff, Vic. I think we have much more to talk about. But I think for episode two, unless you have anything else you want to contribute here, this sounds like we've deep dove a little bit further into understanding the Mexican narcotic culture and you know, people will continue to learn through the expert himself, Mr. Victor Galarza. So anything else you want to add in before we wrap this episode up?
I'm here. Questions, answers. Just email me at vicstreetcop.com. And I will do my best to answer at the best of my ability those questions that you might have. Please hit me up.
Oh, amazing. Just wanted to continue to thank everybody for our continued support here at Street Cop Training and giving us an opportunity to go out there and share this information with everybody. And if you enjoyed this podcast, share it with a friend. Let them know that you like it. And that's all we ask for. So without further ado, thank you, Vic, for being here.
Gracias. Buenas noches.
Adios, amigo.